A platform for Putin today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Russian President Vladimir Putin gave his annual end-of-year press conference today, and Russian TV anchor Mikhail Fishman was listening.
It's always revealing when Putin talks for 4 hours. He can't hide his thoughts, basically.
And let's just say Putin's thoughts about U.S. lawmakers were particularly interesting today. Plus, 6 months after the Grenfell Tower fire in London, some survivors struggle to move on.
You begin to feel survivor's guilt. And why was it them? Why not? Why wasn't it us? Why did we survive? Why didn't they? And that will always be something that will be eating away at our minds.
Plus, the New York utility workers helping to bring the power back on in Puerto Rico. Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Welcome. Good to have you here today. If it is December, it's Putin time. Vladimir Putin always has a lot to say at his end-of-year press conferences. And today in Moscow, the Russian president returned to the podium once again for a nearly four-hour session with reporters. Here are just two of the things Putin told his audience. He said claims that Russia meddled in last year's U.S. elections are fake and that any contacts between Trump's campaign and Russian officials were part of normal diplomatic practice. That's what stood out for us here in our newsroom in Boston. But we also wanted to know what it all sounded like to a Russian journalist. Mikhail Fishman was in the room today. He's an anchor at the Russian independent television channel TV Rain.
We all know from the very start what to expect. Basically, it's a hall full of reporters, if they can be called reporters, because they are more as representatives of regions, of industries, and they all are struggling to get not necessarily even a question, but it could be gratitude or just some words together with Putin. That's what they are fighting for. And this is what the show is all basically about. Putin talking to nation through his messengers, I would say. But there are also few, two, three, four representatives of independent media, which is still alive, but is not in a very good shape. And they also want to come out with their questions about what we really care about. And the art here is more to deliver a question than to expect a real answer.
So these are fairly predictable events. They last long. But what today was a high point for you?
It's always revealing when Putin talks for 4 hours. He can't hide his thoughts, basically. And for me, it was clear that he was very visibly bored talking about issues that nation actually cares about, like healthcare, like education, like economy, like growth, which turned into stagnation for a few years already. And it was very clear that he does not have economic plan for his next term. At least it does not exist in his head.
So there was one telling moment when there was a question asked by journalist Tatiana Felgenhauer. She's the deputy editor of Echo Moskvy radio station. And she made headlines last month when a man broke into the station's studios in Moscow and stabbed her in the throat. Here she is.
Мы видим две разные правовые реальности. В одной активно работает...
So, Mikhail, what did she ask, and how did Putin respond to it?
She basically delivered a very good little speech about unequal access to justice in Russia, which is, I'd say, the most sensitive and the most disturbing problem that we have. She compared various criminal cases, and like the investigation of the murder of Boris Nemtsov, who has been killed in 2015, when the investigators didn't get access to their key witness because he just didn't open the door. And she compared it to the pressure, real pressure, that the state put on those who they see as the enemies of the state. And this was a very revealing speech, which she turned into a question of what Putin thinks of this inequality of when it comes to justice in Russia.
Yeah, what did Putin say to this provocative statement about unequal justice for all?
He was visibly angry with the question. He didn't expect it. He said, no, the justice is equal for everyone. And if you have your own opinion, well, you should address the courts, Russian court system.
So Putin threw a bit of shade at the U.S. Congress today. Here he is responding to a question from the Associated Press's Kate DePuri about U.S. efforts to persuade Russia to do more about North Korea. Here's Putin's response in translation.
Have you noticed that your congressmen, your senators, they look so well, so nice, so handsome? They have ties and shirts, and they seem to be smart people, but they put us on the same shelf with North Korea and Iran. And at the same time, they ask the U.S. president to address the issues of North Korea and the Iranian nuclear program together with us.
Wow. Got some applause.
You see how this is different from any press conference that you can imagine when journalists, or those who they call journalists, actually applauding their leader when he's answering the question.
Why do you think Vladimir Putin keeps doing this performance now 18 years running?
This is actually, at least it was during all these years, a very effective way to show he is in charge of everything.
For skeptics like you and others in your generation, can Putin convince you that, you know, Grandpa still has a few tricks in the bag?
No, he doesn't talk to those who share my views about what Russia should be or could be in the future. No, he is talking to his base. He is talking to majority of Russian nation, which by all measures, by all polls, supports Putin. He knows that he is backed up by the majority of the nation. That's what makes him feel so comfortable. And it was visible today at his press conference for sure.
Mikhail Fishman, anchor at Russian independent television channel TV Rain. Thanks a lot for your thoughts. Really good to speak.
Thank you very much.
Putin did not spend a lot of time today talking about the Middle East, but Russian influence in the region is steadily growing. Syria is the most obvious example, where Russia intervened militarily in 2015. But Russia is also working with Iran, and now it's gaining influence with Turkey and Egypt. Ishan Tharoor writes in the Washington Post this week that Putin is outplaying Trump in the Middle East.
The thrust of my piece focused on how, at a time when Trump has triggered a great amount of outrage in the region, as seen by all the angry statements from various Middle Eastern capitals over his recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, Russia, Vladimir Putin, in a whirlwind trip, went to three Middle Eastern countries and exhibited the kind of clever, strategic foreign policy making that the U.S. is simply not doing in the region.
What are those three countries?
So he went to Syria, Egypt, and Turkey. In each place, you could see Putin both successfully grandstanding on many of his own pet issues, building influence with certain players, proving again to other actors around the region that, for example, in Syria, he was able to stand by his ally in Bashar al-Assad and follow through and basically save that regime. And so he had this kind of grand mission accomplished moment with Assad this week. And in Egypt, he inked a lucrative multi-billion dollar nuclear energy contract with the Egyptian government. And in Turkey, he gave Turkish President Erdogan a moment to grandstand against Trump over Jerusalem. And of course, Putin and Erdogan themselves have met each other 8 times this year and seen a rapid rejuvenation of Russian-Turkish ties, especially compared to 2 years ago when Turkey was shooting down Russian jets. So in overall, what you're seeing is Russia steadily coming in and rebuilding ties, asserting its influence, being an active player in the region at a time when the U.S. policy in the Middle East is incredibly inconsistent and incoherent.
How much of this boost in Russian influence in the Middle East is just due to U.S. inaction or action?
I think that's a huge part of it. On one hand, you had an Obama administration that gave the Russians basically the context in which they could intervene in Syria and showcase their great military firepower. And at the same time, you have a White House now that is playing all sorts of different cards that don't all really add up. This is you're seeing this now in Turkey. You're seeing this now in northern Iraq, in northern Syria, where the Russians have made overtures to factions there. They're just playing their cards well. And the U.S., which has a much greater hand, is not playing that hand that well.
So what is Russia's goal ultimately in the Mideast? Like, how does it serve Moscow's interest to increase its influence in this region? What is the benefit?
For Putin, it's all about domestic optics more than anything else. He has staked his political legitimacy on being this world historic figure who is returning Russia to prominence on the world stage. And so Russia's capacity to, say, project power outside, away from even Eastern Europe, and that's what he did with the Syria intervention, was very important. Russia's capacity to be a proactive and productive player in regional geopolitics and diplomacy is important to him as well. He cares about, you know, placing Russia as a world leader. And the optics of that and the opportunities he's been able to take advantage of in the recent years has all played into his hand.
Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs writer with The Washington Post. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Shifting gears now, I'm wondering what mouse ears will look like with a fox's tail. Disney announced a deal today to buy most of 21st Century Fox's assets. The deal still has to be approved by U.S. regulators. If the acquisition does go through, though, it won't just create an American giant, but a global one as well. Stuart Clark reports for Variety in London. This is going to have huge international ramifications, Stuart. What are the advantages for Disney and Fox in global markets?
I think the very clear advantage is scale. You have to think that the media landscape is shifting very fast internationally as well as obviously in the US. And increasingly, you need leverage and scale. And suddenly, two very big companies have become one huge player that will be able to take on the Netflixes, Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook.
So this is not just movie theaters. You're talking online as well.
Absolutely. You have to look at how people are consuming content now. So clearly the kind of movie theaters, is a piece of it. These guys own a large part of the kind of the theatrical supply chain. They have a lot of the big movie franchises. But then what happens to those movies after they play in theaters? They go onto streaming services. They go onto TV. They go onto on-demand services. So in terms of that part of the value chain in particular, it's significant.
So let's talk about the possible effects of this merger on two very muscular media markets, India and the UK. What is the advantage for Disney in India, first of all?
Well, India is a huge market with hundreds of millions of homes and consumers that you can reach out to. And again, I think it speaks to my previous point. When you have that kind of scale, it enables you to do a lot more in terms of the kind of deals you can do and the kind of services you can roll out.
What about the UK? What's the advantage for Disney in the UK?
Well, the UK is particularly interesting. I'm sitting here in London, and for weeks we've been reporting in depth on Fox's attempt to buy the piece of Sky that it does not own. What this deal
does... That's one of the big channels there.
Sky is not a channel in and of itself. Sky is actually a pay TV platform. It's the equivalent of DirecTV.
Uh-huh.
So what it does is house hundreds and hundreds of channels. Now, historically, Disney has put its channels on the Sky platform, on the satellite platform. Now, what this deal has done is positioned it as the owner of the platform, which is significant because it means it owns the content, it supplies it to a platform that it part owns already. And it just gives it huge scale and leverage.
Would this merger affect the kind of TV and films that get made, like the actual content? I mean, could Disney go on to produce local language films?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and I think that's one that only time will tell. That's not a stated intention at this point, but when you have a combined group with that kind of heft, you would expect them to move into new areas in terms of content, as well as having that very premium big ticket stuff that they already have in the movie theaters and on TV.
Can you imagine what different content might get produced?
Well, I think if Disney were to launch a streaming service internationally, so it has one already in the UK called Disney Life. If you do that, you can't just populate that service with US content. The blockbusters are great. They still drive a huge number of eyeballs, but that's not enough on its own. You have to have local content. And I think Netflix and Amazon have increasingly realized that Disney's very savvy. So if it does roll out that kind of service, you can expect them to ramp up the amount of local content that they produce.
Stuart Clark with Variety in London. Thanks very much.
No problem. Thank you.
In Puerto Rico, turning the lights on house by house. That's next on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. When officials said it would take a long time to fix Puerto Rico's power grid, they meant a really long time. It's been almost 3 months since the island and its grid were battered by back-to-back hurricanes. And even today, about a third of Puerto Rico is without power. In the capital, San Juan, though, there's a group of utility workers from New York going house by house, getting the lights back on. Daniela Cheslow rode along with one electrical engineer to check out what's going on.
Generators rumble as I walk through Old San Juan with electrical engineer Aaron Anaya. They're an indicator many shops and homes still don't have power.
Can you imagine New Yorkers going for 70-something days without power?
No, I don't know. I could imagine it.
Anaya works for a subsidiary of Con Edison in New York. He was a crew supervisor fixing the New York grid after Superstorm Sandy knocked out power. That took 2 weeks. Anaya lives north of New York City, and he's on a 5-week assignment in San Juan, one of about 450 New York power workers here now.
See, look at those poles they have up on the buildings there. You can see some of them are tied or braced up.
Anaya coordinates work crews as they go street by street, restringing cables. They have to ship every post, wire, and truck to the island. Con Ed alone has 35 trucks here, but Anaya says...
We need a lot more, yeah, because the further out you go from Old San Juan, it just, the area becomes greater, but the damage is the same.
He visits a crew working outside the yellow and white Cathedral of San Juan. The church was built in 1521 and rebuilt over the centuries after hurricanes hit.
The architecture is, I don't know, from another time. It's beautiful.
That architecture is one reason for the delay in restoring power.
This is stuff that we're not used to. We don't work at back home.
Richard Gonzalez supervises this crew. He's from the Bronx and grew up in the Dominican Republic.
Definitely, it's challenging to work on the rooftops. Not poles, it's a post up there and getting access and very tight streets with a lot of pedestrian and vehicular traffic.
One of his workers drills into a wooden post to attach new cables. It's not just the physical infrastructure that's a challenge here. Puerto Rico's power authority, PREPA, is giving the repair orders, and it's in disarray. The director resigned in November amid questions over a $300 million contract he awarded to the small Montana firm Whitefish Energy to restore the grid. That deal was later canceled. The utility is also $9 billion in debt, and over the years, maintenance has lagged. Down on the street, Aaron Anaya points to the tangled cables overhead. He says when he arrived, PREPA's maps only referred to street addresses. The New York workers were used to seeing detailed information about every electric pole.
It's a mess when you're out here in the field. So we developed the system to number each one of these poles so that we have a reference and you can coordinate in the switching room with the men in the field.
There are no clear records of all the power customers, so the New York crews don't know how much progress they've made. The mayor of San Juan estimates half the city still lacks electricity. Still, every day, a few more lights go on.
What just happened?
Oh, these are heroes! They just gave us light. We have been without light since September. So they have done a great job.
Marisol Maldonado hugs a Con Ed lineman outside the travel agency where she works. They actually lost power after Hurricane Irma, 2 weeks before Hurricane Maria.
We had no system, we had no phone, we had no light, we had no copy, no internet, no anything. So it has been so difficult.
The governors of New York and Puerto Rico announced a plan this week to rebuild the island's power system to withstand future hurricanes and integrate more renewables. The sun beats down here, even in December, and yet most people rely on a rickety national grid that burns oil. Aaron Anaya says he's pushing ahead with fixing that grid.
As far as the future, the system that has to be designed by engineers and... It takes time to do that, and these people have been waiting long enough.
On the local radio, there have been calls for people to honk at the Con Ed trucks to say thanks. Richard Gonzalez says it's a great feeling.
I laugh every time somebody starts honking the horn. while we're driving down, what am I doing? I look around, it's like, what am I doing? Am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? And you realize just that's their way of saying thanks.
For The World, Daniela Cheslow, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
6 months ago, London had its single worst disaster since World War II. A high-rise called Grenfell Tower caught fire that night, and 71 people died. Today, on the half-year anniversary, people of different faiths gathered at St. Paul's Cathedral to mourn the dead. Friends, relatives, and first responders all united in their grief.
On behalf of this cathedral in London, welcome each one of you to this national memorial service of remembrance, community, and hope. This is a nation that grieves at the unspeakable tragedy, loss, and hurt of that June day.
The service included a montage of voices about the night of the tragedy, set to sounds from the oud, a North African lute familiar to many of the immigrant families who lived in the tower.
My dad automatically realized something was wrong, so he ran up the stairs, told my mum to go downstairs, ran up, called everyone on our floor, and woke me and my brother up.
I smelt smoke, but I assumed it was my mum always has a little candle. So I went to blow out the candle. Like, it was a very, very faint, smoky smell.
The windows broke. Things were falling to the floor. And then in the space of 6 minutes, the fire had already reached six floors above it.
I could not thank these people enough. They've provided their services, their clothes, their food, their money.
There's a picture right there. If you see the picture, she's missing. We're looking for her. And she's friend to my little children as well. So they're at home always crying, thinking, Daddy, we're not going to see her again.
You begin to feel survivor's guilt. And I think maybe not now, but within the next couple of months, we will start to question, why was it them? Why wasn't it us? Why did we survive? Why didn't they? And that will always be something that will be eating away at our minds.
Many folks in the pews had to wipe away tears, but a girls' choir from two local Islamic schools had a hopeful message for them.
Inshallah, 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 you'll find your way.
And Bishop Graham Tomlin spoke to the congregation about the day after the Grenfell fire.
A crowd of people had turned up to help. And what struck me was the variety. Every ethnicity, background, age. For a moment, we all lost our fear of each other. We lost our obsession with ourselves, and we reached out across the city in love for our neighbor.
The Ebony Steel Band there playing Leonard Cohen's classic, Hallelujah, at today's memorial service for the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire in London, 6 months ago. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. On the eve of the Korean War, an American Marine met his future wife.
And years later, I asked her, how come you would never go on a date with me when I asked you? Later on, she said, oh, yes, I always liked you too, but my mother didn't like anybody going out with me.
Their story, still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. When it comes to entertaining the possibility of diplomatic talks between the U.S. and North Korea, the Trump administration has been sending mixed messages. Here's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson speaking at the Atlantic Council in Washington on Tuesday.
Let's just meet. And we can talk about the weather if you want. We can talk about whether it's going to be a square table or a round table if that's what you're excited about. But can we at least sit down and see each other face to face? And then we can begin to lay out a map, a roadmap, of what we might be willing to work towards. I don't think it's not realistic to say we're only going to talk if you come to the table ready to give up your program.
Tillerson was referring there to North Korea's nuclear program. Then yesterday, the White House and Tillerson's own State Department seemed to contradict what the secretary said on Tuesday. For more on this, let's turn to Colm Lynch. He's senior diplomatic reporter with Foreign Policy magazine.
The American position up until Tillerson made those remarks is that the North Koreans would first have to commit to dismantling their nuclear program and take steps in that direction before they could talk. So, you know, the initial sort of indication was this was a pretty strong reversal of policy, but it seems that he didn't have the president on board.
Yeah, so tell us what's going on, Colm, because Tillerson, as you said, he said Trump feels the same way, but apparently they don't. What is the real message?
So, one of confusion and mixed messages, as has been the case, you know, since the beginning of the year. The White House subsequently put out a statement saying that the North Koreans would have to take a number of steps, that this is not the right time for talks. And then by the following day, I think last night, I got an email from the State Department saying that, essentially that this isn't the right time, that certain steps have to be taken before talks. So it was a pretty stunning reversal of policies in two different directions over 24 hours. And it's hard to see North Koreans, you know, as a result of this, committing to talk to the Americans. I wrote a piece yesterday which sort of described how the North Koreans have been themselves moving away from the prospect of talks. They, you know, they're upset about President Trump's speech before the General Assembly, where he talked about totally destroying North Korea, and also the subsequent imposition of new sanctions on North Korea by the White House. So I think at this point it's looking like neither side is really ready to talk.
Yeah, so deadlock in talks, at least for right now. Does the White House just think that sanctions imposed by the U.S. and the U.N. are their roadmap for the near future?
My colleague Dan DeLuce was speaking to somebody in the White House yesterday, and you know, and the feeling that he got is that there are players within the White House that feel like the sanctions are starting to bear fruit. They're working. They're putting increased pressure on the North Koreans, that they have, you know, greater support from the Chinese for enforcing the sanctions than they have in the past. And so they would like to see these play out.
So in recent weeks, we found out that Pyongyang has made a lot of progress in its nuclear weapons and missile programs, even developing a long-range missile. Given these developments, is it too late for talks, even if both sides were interested?
Well, I mean, certainly talks might provide some sort of mutual assurances that these nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles are not going to be fired at the U.S. So, I mean, I would think that even if they do reach, you know, a kind of peak capability, that there would be a rationale for negotiations. I mean, a lot of sort of the experts who, you know, engage with the North Koreans, you know, former U.S. officials who have been kind of in formal communications with the government, some of them think that the North Koreans are sort of waiting until they reach a period in which they feel that, you know, they have all the capability they need for a nuclear deterrent. And once they get to that point, they'll be willing to talk with the Americans, but not about denuclearization.
Colm Lynch with Foreign Policy magazine. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for having me, Marco.
You know, once in a while, I have to remind myself that the Korean War never really ended. There is a ceasefire agreement in place signed in 1953 after 3 years of fighting and millions of deaths. George Lampman was in South Korea when that conflict started in June 1950. For him, though, there are some good memories of that time. It's when he met his wife. Lampman was recently back in Seoul, and Jason Strother caught up with him there.
Seoul doesn't look much like it did when 21-year-old George Lampman arrived here in 1949.
I recognize the Bank of Korea building.
That's just down the street from the former site of the U.S. Embassy, where Lampman worked as part of a Marine security attachment.
In that circle there, we used to go to the store there, the Washin department store.
Lampman is 90 now, and his memory about that time is sharp, especially when he's talking about how he met Lee Suki.
She was a beautiful girl. Very, very intelligent.
Suki worked the embassy's switchboard. George says he tried to ask her out on dates.
Years later, I asked her, I said, how come you would never go on a date with me when I asked you? She said, oh, yes, I always liked you too, but my mother didn't like anybody going out with me.
It wasn't just her mother who kept Suki and George apart.
Here, the Russian-dominated North Koreans launched a full-scale, well-prepared drive on the capital of the South, Seoul.
When the Korean War broke out on June 25, 1950, George was evacuated to Japan and then reassigned to the American Embassy in Saigon. A few months later, U.S. forces under General Douglas MacArthur liberated Seoul, and George returned to South Korea. Suki was back at her job, too, and George finally got permission from her mother to take her out. George says in those early months, everyone talked about how the war was all but won.
All the boys will be home by Thanksgiving. We got it made. On to the Yalu. Everybody was very complacent.
In this atmosphere, George and Suki got married in a traditional ceremony at her family's home in Seoul. But just a week after their wedding, everything changed.
Disaster suddenly struck. An estimated 250,000 Red Chinese soldiers attacked the Allied lines. The United Nations troops were forced to retreat.
The Chinese army came to North Korea's rescue and was about to seize Seoul.
One morning I went to work. Other guy had come out of the building and said, George, forget it. The building's empty. Everybody's left already. You're on your own. Head for Pusan.
George packed a truck with supplies, and he and Suki headed out of the city, along with 19 South Korean employees of the U.S. Embassy. He may have saved their lives. George says he remembers how the dirt roads were jam-packed with refugees, bugging-out soldiers, ox carts, and broken-down vehicles. And he can't forget the death he saw along the way.
Along the side of the road, you could see little groups. You knew they were families, because there'd be some little bundles, too. The ground was frozen. They could lay down in the paddock, and they'd fall asleep and freeze to death. And they'd all be huddled up together.
George and Suki made it to safety in Busan, and in 1951, they arrived in the U.S. to start their lives there, though the war continued for nearly two more years. They eventually settled outside of Washington, D.C. George says Suki studied English for 3 years, learned how to cook American food, and kept a garden that was the talk of the neighborhood. I asked George if he and Suki talked to their four children about their experiences in Korea during the war.
Did you and Suki talk much? Was that something
I don't think. Mama didn't talk much about that.
He turns to his daughter, Margaret Phillips, who's here in Seoul with him.
Mama regarded that time in her life when she met you as the highlight of her life.
As what?
The highlight of her life.
In 2015, George and Suki and their entire family made a trip to Seoul. George says they wanted to show their kids where their mother was born. But as he puts it, fate called the game one night.
We went back to our hotel room and Suki died in her sleep that night. It was fate here, scarcely a mile and a half from where she was born. 85 years later, she died.
When Latman was in Seoul recently, he spoke to students at Lee Suki's old elementary school. He says he plans to place a small memorial there in honor of the woman who survived the Korean War with him all those years ago. For the World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
2 months ago, the small Mediterranean island of Malta was rocked by the brutal murder of a journalist. Her name was Daphne Caruana Galizia. She was killed by a car bomb that ripped her vehicle apart as she was driving. Caruana Galizia was an investigative reporter whose work focused on government corruption and organized crime. One of the most powerful people she investigated, Malta's prime minister. She's vowed to bring those responsible to justice. And earlier this month, the island's police said it had arrested several suspects in the case. My BBC colleague Tim Yule has just produced a BBC radio documentary about the case called Daphne and the Two Maltas. Tim Yule, first of all, why was Daphne Caruana Galizia's murder such an important event for Malta?
Well, I think it's important almost for the whole world, for the whole of Europe, and that's why it really didn't just create a storm on Malta. I mean, politicians throughout Europe, throughout the world condemned it. I mean, certainly the world is becoming a more dangerous place for journalists in general. You know, we can see that everywhere, but we see it mainly in war zones. We see it mainly in fairly authoritarian countries like, for example, Russia, which has a very bad record. We really do not see journalists being murdered simply because of what they write in Western European democracies. This is an extraordinarily rare event, if you think about it. Mm. She was simply killed for doing her job. You know, there needs to be no further explanation of why this is a big event, you know, and why this is shocking. And just to be, you know, just to be clear, when you say one of Malta's most outspoken political bloggers, I mean, obviously Malta is a very, very small country. It's the smallest country in the European Union, less than 500,000 people. But she wasn't one of the most outspoken bloggers. She was by miles, by head and shoulders, the bravest, the most outspoken, the most rigorous, the most forensic of all Malta's journalists, you know, and in the top rank of all Europe's journalists in that respect.
So your documentary is titled Daphne and the Two Maltas. What are the two Maltas?
Well, this is not a distinction I'm making. This is very much a distinction that Daphne herself made. She referred to these two Maltas, the two halves of her own country. And for her, one Malta, which she obviously regarded herself as belonging to, very much the smaller Malta, was a Malta that was very interested in ethics, in morality, in good governance. And the other Malta, which she felt was in the end interested in bettering themselves, family links. You know, if certain morals dropped, it didn't matter if families benefited. So to give you an example, this is a clip from the person who would like to see himself as the successor to Daphne, the political blogger Manuel de Lea, very much, if you like, representing one Malta's reaction to her death. And this is what he says.
There's no doubt in my mind that this is a political killing, that the motivations in order for this to happen are so strong and the benefits for people in politics are so high that I will find it very difficult to be persuaded that there's any other reason for this to have happened.
And I'm going to play you another clip, which is from some supporters of the government speaking outside the Labour Club in one of the government's biggest strongholds. This is what they said about Daphne's death.
We're very sorry for her death.
But it was her fault. She was so cruel with everyone.
If you're in the middle of the road, if you're hit by a car, it is your fault because you're in the middle of the road. So you're expecting to be hit by a car. You know what I mean?
I think I should stress immediately that is quite extreme. You know, when we talk about the two Maltas, both the Maltas, if you like, in general, there was deep sympathy for her. How could there not be?
With Daphne gone, this intrepid, dogged investigative journalist gone now, how skilled are the other journalists on Malta?
Well, I think everybody, you know, the fairly small journalistic community on Malta, I think they feel her death very, very strongly. It's a gigantic vacuum, a gigantic gap that really can't be very easily filled. So I think there are people starting to do that, but a feeling that, you know, Malta's authorities will be very considerably less held to account because she's gone.
My colleague at the BBC, Tim Ewell, just back from Malta, where he was reporting on the death of investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
With a few seconds before the break, let me give you a preview of something we're working on for tomorrow's show. Our World in Words podcast is looking into artificial speech, you know, how computers learn to sound like people. But getting one to sound like you and maybe say things you never even said, yeah, that's happening now.
I mean, there's so many really big consequences that could happen because of someone having something that sounds like an authentic recording of your voice.
We try out the technology on my voice. Scary. That's tomorrow here on the show. Here's one consequence of rising tuition fees. Food insecurity, like students going hungry as they struggle to pay tuition and other expenses. It is a growing problem on college campuses across the country. In California, thousands of students qualify for CalFresh, the state's food stamps program, but many people don't know that's actually an option. The University of California's Basic Needs Security Committee is trying to educate students about their resources across its 10 campuses. Ruben Canedo is the co-chair of the committee and works at UC Berkeley. So for people who may not know, Ruben, how do you define basic needs?
For us, basic needs comes down to three areas. One is financial, two is food, three is housing. And when you put those together, we also name that that has a direct impact on the health, the wellness, the academic performance, and the overall quality of life of students.
So let's focus on the food. How many students at the University of California report food insecurity?
So right now, 39% of students at UC Berkeley specifically that are undergraduates are food insecure, as well as 23% of graduate students are food insecure. So both of our student populations are struggling, and that compares to the larger 48% insecurity rate of undergraduates across the 10 UC campuses and 25% of food insecurity rate for graduate students across the 10 UC campuses as well.
Wow. So what does food insecurity actually look like on a day-to-day basis? Like, what kind of stories do you hear from students?
I think students, as they're thinking about applying to college, most of the time are talking about the requirements of the application and how to make their application as competitive as possible. And we don't go the next stage of that, which is once you're in college, you're going to have to figure out how to provide for yourself. Some of the students that qualify for financial aid struggle because once they get to the community that they're going to be a part of, they have to pay for a safety deposit and the first month of rent. And when the student receives their financial aid package, they pay for that safety deposit. And now they're out sometimes a third, sometimes half, sometimes more than half of the money that they were supposed to have for the entire semester. So they're very tight on money until they find a job or apply for scholarships or find a way to decrease their basic needs costs, which most of the time, because they have to pay for the books for their academics, they end up sacrificing their nutrition, meaning that they're skipping meals, eating once a day, if that. And there's other students who are not skipping meals, but the nutrition of the meal itself is very, very lacking. So that cup of noodles student that eats a piece of bread and coffee, which there's no nutritional value or content to what they're consuming. Our larger food insecurity rates now we know are for students that are former foster youth, students that are first-generation college goers, students that are underrepresented ethnic minorities. There is a consistent challenge of food insecurity across the socioeconomic spectrum.
Let's talk solutions for a moment, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about CalFresh, California's food stamp program. What's going on at the state level to help hungry students?
So CalFresh historically hasn't been as inclusive for college students. Full-time student status wasn't being considered in their ability or inability to work 20 hours a week or 80 hours a month. What we've been working on for the last 4 years is helping look at the eligibility language from the federal government and essentially translate that to the college financial language to maximize the amount of students that are eligible, given that we have an estimated 10,000 potentially eligible students at UC Berkeley.
California, as you know, it's a sanctuary state for undocumented people. Do you think the help ought to reflect kind of California's position?
Absolutely. We know that undocumented community members are not going to qualify for the federal resources, which is what we are being very proactive to doing some population data analysis so that our strategies and resource allocation address the highest need and work backwards from there. We want to make sure that the state of California and the UC system make not just a political, but also a resource statement that says college students are a priority for us. Basic need insecurity should not be part of the college experience. And we know that by supporting the student population, they will graduate, they will go into our communities, and they will return that investment.
Ruben Canedo, the co-chair of the Basic Needs Security Committee at UCal Berkeley, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. What they do? Okay.
finally today, welcome to our public radio glowing neon nightclub. No, actually, you're listening to What It Do, the latest track from MC African Boy. It's clearly a danceable, club-ready track, but it sneaks in elements of childhood and travels, Nigerian juju, with occasional dips into grime. African Boy is from Southeast London by way of Nigeria. The influences of those places are not heavy-handed in this song, so when we spoke, I had to ask where they pop up for him.
Everybody wants to know my style. Checking my snaps, I'm around the town. I travel the world like a refugee. Without no visa, it's plain to see. Look, African Boy, no be engineer, but I can fix it.
Can we hear in What It Do, like, how those influences come together?
Yeah, you can definitely hear that in What It Do because, like, Jangadova, Eko Moto. It's actually called Jingolova Lakomota, which is probably something from the British colonial times that came into Nigeria, but we turned it into Jangadova, Eko Moto. And that's something that I always heard my mom sing to me as a kid, you know, just one of these Nigerian nursery rhymes I used to sing. And What It Do is me crafting my own sound, making it my own, having elements of my culture there, but I'm gonna, you know, acknowledge all these different sounds that surround me, but I'm gonna make my own.
The influences are subtle, but there's clearly not just one way to connect to home or to people for African Boy. The song itself calls for many people to join in.
I guess, you know, it is a call for action. It's a call and response. It's just something that people say to each other. So it's just like What It Do. And I kind of wanted to make a song that was accessible to everyone, that was... that got people moving and just got people interacting with each other. Everybody wanna know her style, and they see her be swerving around the town. They be like, hubba, 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 let me hold up, please, chop it down, low, please, show me your back up. She be like, please, please
throw your visa. I ain't got time for none of your wahala. Our future folk stories are a collaboration with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. If you listen really closely, you can hear it all. MC African Boy there with What It Do, and that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.